Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how a new federal rule could impact air quality and the economy across the valley.
And making meaning out of mythology written in the stars. And music.
But first, in the midst of negotiations over the future of the overallocated Colorado River, there's a conference this week in Boulder that typically draws water managers from upper and lower basin states. But not this year. With me now to talk about why and who will be there is Alex Hager of KUNC, who's in Boulder. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for being here. So, first of all, what is this conference, I guess, in a typical year?
Well, it is an annual gathering. This is the 45th annual gathering of people with a stake in the Colorado River, tribal leaders, scientists, policymakers. And, you know, usually it's kind of wonky policy talks, but in the last few years, those wonky policy talks have been a little more newsworthy just because there are so many people trying to find any hints on what the future of the Colorado River might be. And over the past few years, they've gotten some. The top negotiators, one from each of the seven states that uses the Colorado River, have typically, for the last few years, showed up and spoken publicly and occasionally taken some public questions. This year, that's not the case.
Is it the public nature of it that has kept those water managers away?
You know, I'm speculating a little bit here, but it does seem to be the case. You know, when I reached out to policymakers ahead of this conference to ask why they wouldn't be coming, a lot of them said that they're really just focused on these negotiations. The negotiations tend to happen behind closed doors. Typically, this conference is really only one of two times every year when those people all appear on one stage together and can take questions from some of those other people whose, you know, lives and livelihoods will be impacted by their decisions.
Mm. So who will be there, if not the sort of the top water managers, and what's on the agenda?
Well, it's still a lot of incredibly smart and influential people. You have people with really important roles in the governance of some of the 30 tribes that use the Colorado River's water. You have a climate scientist who can give projections on how exactly demand will need to be adjusted because they have a good idea of what supply will look like. And, you know, on the sides of these more official talks, there's going to be an opportunity for people to meet in a hallway that wouldn't necessarily meet each other. You know, the heads of nonprofits running into other academics or tribal leaders or scientists and having conversations that could, in some other ways, in some less formal ways, you know, push the Colorado River conversation forward.
Sure. So you have talked on this show many times about sort of reading the tea leaves, reading the signals about, you know, what folks are saying in terms of what that might mean for talks on the river and negotiations and where they are. Is there anything to be read into the fact that all of these states are not sending their top negotiators? Like, does that say anything about the state of negotiations or anything really?
Well, the one notable exception is that the representative from California has showed up sort of as a private citizen just to sit and listen and learn. And he is certainly a popular character at these meetings this week because there are relatively a few of his peers in the room.
Yeah.
I wouldn't read into it too much. The main takeaway for me is just that these negotiations are probably not going very well. I think if there was good news, these negotiators might be more willing to share it. You know, from what we've seen over the past year or year and some change is that these policymakers have really made up their minds. They are digging in their heels on policy stances about, you know, who should have to deal with the sting of water cutbacks to adjust to a shrinking river. And right now they are not, you know, they're not willing to make substantial sacrifices that would push this forward. There's a long-running rivalry going back more than a century now between the upper basin states of Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, New Mexico, and the lower basin states of Arizona, Nevada, and California. And both of them have split into their separate camps with sort of distinct ideas of this is how much we're willing to offer and this is how much we're not willing to offer in terms of water cutbacks. And there hasn't been a lot of room in between.
Well, it sounds like maybe the stars of next year's version of this conference will be all the attorneys involved in the lawsuits.
That is entirely possible. Those folks are here, but I think they probably will not be sharing very much.
That seems reasonable. Alex, let me ask you before we let you go about another story that you reported not that long ago about some pretty stark numbers in terms of where we are in groundwater and sort of not as much of it as we once had.
Yeah, that's right. Groundwater is being depleted in a really significant way within the Colorado River Basin, and the most significant depletion of groundwater has been happening in Arizona. And this new study uses NASA satellite data to really kind of put some numbers on the rate and volume of that depletion. And, you know, when I talked to groundwater experts about what exactly this means, they said, look, we have been really concerned with Colorado River water shortages. And, you know, you see news headlines every other day about how much water is in Lake Mead. And there's pictures of how far it's dropped against the back of Hoover Dam. And they said, if we could see what was going on with groundwater, it would be the same level of alarm.
So, I mean, this is obviously groundwater recharge is extremely difficult. And I would imagine that water managers, when they're looking at the situation on the Colorado River, this is not probably, I would think, helping try to figure out what everyone's going to do.
It's not. It adds another layer of complication. You know, as the amount of water in the Colorado River and its major reservoirs goes down, cities, farms in Arizona and beyond are going to be looking around to try to find other sources of water. Groundwater is a big one. And so far, there has been a gentle increasing of reliance on that as a resource that could go up. And, you know, the experts I talked to said, without more substantial regulation for how much groundwater can be drawn from where, it's only going to get worse.
Interesting. All right. That is Alex Hager of KUNC in Colorado. Alex, good to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Take care.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency earlier this year announced it will get rid of a policy that would have reclassified the valley's air pollution status into a worse level. By not including the region in the serious non-attainment category, environmental officials here will get more leeway to prove that at least some of our air quality problems are caused by pollution coming here from other countries, including Mexico. EPA officials visited the valley this spring. During those meetings, some officials had asked for the change. We have two perspectives on this today, starting with Greg Blackie, Deputy Director of Policy for the Arizona Free Enterprise Club. His group supports the change. And Greg, why is this rule change by the EPA a good thing in your mind?
Yeah, it's critical. We've been engaged in this issue for several years, at least 2.5, maybe 3, with this ozone problem. And we pointed out that it's really the result of two things. One is shifting goalposts. And so the required attainment level for ozone in the 90s was 84 parts per billion. It was shifted in 2008 to 75, and then in 2015 down to 70 parts per billion. So the goalposts keep moving. We keep meeting those and then, you know, coming out of compliance again. So that's one primary reason. The second is that 80% of the emissions in our area come from outside of this country. So they're coming from China and Mexico, completely outside of our control. And we don't think that residents, business owners should be held accountable for emissions they can't control. And that's really the crux of the issue. And I think that the new administration is going to work with Arizona to make sure that we're not held accountable for things outside of our control.
How do we know where the emissions are coming from? Like, how can you track that?
It's a great question. Our organization cannot, but those at the Maricopa Association of Governments, ADEQ, and this impacts other Intermountain West states too, like the state of Utah, where they deal with this issue as well. And 95% of their emissions are outside of their control, either wildfires or emissions emanating from outside of the country. And this is set up in the Clean Air Act itself. And so there's an understanding that we would be able to attract or track these emissions that are coming from outside of the United States and see them kind of shift over the Pacific Ocean and blow into the Intermountain West states like Arizona.
I wonder if this is in some ways the same that we've heard from folks talk about before, like for the fine particulate matter, the PM2.5, that, you know, we live in a desert. It's very dusty here. Like, we can't really control that. And yet we're out of compliance with air quality standards because of that fact. It sounds like this is very much kind of the same thing.
Yes, very similar. But ozone maybe even more so because of the required control measures or what the EPA under the Biden administration wanted to force on us.
So regardless of where the emissions come from, there is still the issue that, like, the air quality is not always great here. So what do you think we should be doing, or what do you think the county or the state or the federal government, like, what should happen to try to make it so that, you know, in the winter we don't have this giant brown cloud hanging over the valley, or that, you know, just in general the air is healthier to breathe?
Well, and I think that if you asked the county and the planners, that they would say we've already adopted 90 control measures over the last several decades that have worked. We have cleaner air now than we did 20 years ago. And you can look at the charts from the EPA, from our air quality planners, and see that every year our precursor emissions are reduced. They decrease. And yet there was a decoupling where we continue to reduce our emissions and ozone continues to increase. And one of the best examples is that during COVID, ozone increased substantially. And that was when people stopped driving, businesses were shut down, everything basically came to a halt, and yet ozone continued to rise. And so there's obviously something that we don't quite understand, even the EPA, about what's causing the ozone problem. And so we think that this decision by the Trump administration to pump the brakes while they analyze this and make sure that we're not harming Arizona residents for something that, one, we don't totally understand yet. And then secondly, even if we did impose these restrictions, we wouldn't be able to change what's happening.
Is there something that maybe should be coming from the federal government? I mean, if these are emissions that are coming from other countries, it seems like maybe it shouldn't be on the state or even the county to deal with it. It should be a federal issue.
I think in some respects it should be a federal issue, in that they shouldn't be requiring states to adopt relative or certain control measures to try and do something that they can't do.
From your perspective, what will be the biggest benefits to Maricopa County, maybe to the wider region of this change?
I think the main thing is a breath of fresh air for local residents, of making sure and knowing that we're not going to have these radical control measures adopted. I think for businesses, what the federal government uses as kind of the hammer to force compliance is that if you don't submit a plan that they find attains the ozone attainment level, that it comes with sanctions. So losing federal highway funding, and then emission offsets for businesses. And so if we were to be reclassified as serious non-attainment, then businesses that produce 50 tons of emissions instead of 100 would have to offset 1 to 2. So they would have to find 60 tons of emissions somewhere to shut down in order to open up the new business. So I think across the board, business owners, families, residents can now take a deep breath and know that we have time to study what some of the actual causes of the increase in ozone are in the region.
It sounds like this is very much for you an economic issue.
I think it's an economic and a freedom issue. And so we saw in California and some other states that the proposed control measures primarily targeted residents. So the banning of gas cars, gas stoves, gas lawn equipment. And imagine what that would do for a small business that does landscaping, and they have all gas equipment and gas trucks, and now they've got to, you know, change out all their equipment to electric or to battery powered, or to homes that have to retrofit and take out their gas stoves and replace them with electric stoves, or gas heaters with electric heaters. And so it's both economic and freedom, and for the ability for Maricopa residents to choose the devices that they want most.
Greg Blackie is Deputy Director of Policy for the Arizona Free Enterprise Club. Many health and environmental advocates, however, are not excited about the change. Joanna Strother is Senior Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association in Arizona, and says ozone acts like a sunburn to the lungs. So, Joanna, why to you is this rule change from the EPA such a problem?
Sure. Well, ozone is one of the most widespread and dangerous air pollutants. It impacts your health and obviously your lungs. And so for those reasons, we are concerned about what EPA is doing. We know that there's more we could be doing in Arizona, especially when it comes to protecting people's health.
Do you agree with the assessment that some amount of the ozone that is here in Maricopa County is not from here, that it has come from other places?
Sure. Well, we know weather patterns play a role in where air goes. So yes, absolutely. Especially when it comes to wildfire, we do see wildfire smoke could be hundreds of miles. Could be a California wildfire, and we're seeing it here in Arizona. So yes, absolutely. We do know that air pollution moves around.
So supporters of this rule change from the EPA will say that is evidence that Maricopa County shouldn't be punished for that, that, like, it's not our fault. We're not causing this pollution. Why should we be punished for the fact that it's there? Do you buy into any of that?
No, because there's a lot we can be doing here in Arizona, and we have not acted on ozone or our air pollution burdens in decades. And it's time for us to act. There are policies we could be putting in place that we need to put in place to safeguard our health, policies we know will work and will help to curb air pollution. And that's what we can be doing in Arizona.
What kinds of things do you think we should be doing?
Sure. Investing in clean, renewable energy sources, wind and solar. We have the perfect climate for that. The previous administration, passed billions of dollars, and projects were coming into Arizona, and we want to see those things work. Policy takes time. It's not going to happen overnight. But we need those projects funded so that we can start to clean up air pollution. Also, the transportation sector, one of the largest contributing sectors to our air pollution burdens. We can do a lot, like change out light duty fleet to zero emission vehicles. So there are policies we could be doing right here in Arizona to clean up our air.
Do you think that we should be funding those, or since a lot of this pollution is coming from elsewhere, should the funding also come from elsewhere?
Sure. I think, it's a kind of a 50-50. The federal funding certainly helps. These are big projects. We're talking about multi-million dollars. But there are states that do invest in cleaning up their air pollution. Lots of our sister states around us, California, New Mexico, Colorado, all investing in cleaning up air pollution. And we could be doing that here in Arizona as well.
How does our air quality here in Maricopa County compare to, the last number of years, maybe the last couple of decades?
Sure. In general, so we've been doing our State of the Air report for 26 years. So when we look at trends and majorly due to the Clean Air Act, we have seen that policy works and our air has gotten better. However, is it still safe for our health? No. And in fact, in this last year's report, we've seen more days of ozone. Of course, our changing climate plays into a role. The fact that we're here in a valley also plays a role into that ozone. But again, we can do more here in Arizona.
So one of the concerns that folks who had been pushing for this change had was that a lot of the controls, in their minds anyway, a lot of the controls that would help clean up some of the air are costly and not good for business, not good for the general economy here. Is that a concern that you share?
It is a concern, but you know what? Our health is also impacted financially. It's also a financial burden to our state. Lost work days where people are sick or their children are sick. It actually financially costs our health, our state as well when we look at the health impacts from the air pollution.
So you mentioned that there was federal funding that came during the Biden administration. I think it's probably safe to say there's not going to be much, if any, federal funding coming during the Trump administration for this purpose. So given, as you say, these are very expensive propositions, where should the rest of the money come from?
Sure. I think that our state can look into really, truly investing into cleaning up air pollution, really, truly investing in projects like wind and solar, again, tackling that transportation sector. Those are policies here on the state and local level that we could be doing.
What do you think the ultimate impact will be of this rule changing on Maricopa County?
I think that we're going to see more days of ozone, more days of particle pollution, and more people getting sick.
How big of a difference do you think we'll see in terms of more days with bad air, more of an impact on the hospital and the healthcare system here?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we don't act, we're going to see a lot more people getting sick. There's a direct correlation between when the air quality reaches unhealthy for those sensitive groups specifically. There is a direct correlation between people who visit the emergency room, people who are having asthma attacks. We're going to get sicker as a community, and that's why we need to invest now. We need to protect our health. Again, that has a financial restraint on our economy as well.
Given this new rule from the EPA, though, do you have any measure of optimism that those investments will be made on the state level?
We hope so. You know, the American Lung Association is an advocacy group as well. So we continue to talk to our state lawmakers the importance of really tackling this pollution burden problem that we've seen in the county and across Arizona. We know that other states are doing their part, and so we need to do our part here.
Joanna Strother is Senior Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, according to a new survey, more than half of LGBTQ Americans check their horoscope at least once a year.
You know, when you look at these pictures of the universe and the Hubble telescope and all that, and you see this vast field of stars and planets and galaxies, it's like, do I fit in?
A local horoscope author weighs in on why so many queer people turn to astrology.
But first, as some of the Bob Dylan fans listening may be aware, Arizona plays a central role in Dylan mythology. Legend has it that one night in the late 70s, in a hotel room in Tucson, Dylan was feeling down and out, heartbroken over the collapse of his marriage, exhausted from being on tour. And in that moment, as the story goes, Dylan had a vision of Jesus, which prompted him to dedicate his life to praising God with his music. That phase ended a few years later, but for a little while there, Dylan's music took an explicitly evangelical turn, and he released three records in the late 70s and into the 80s that are often referred to as his gospel trilogy. Writer and musician Jason Woodbury has long been fascinated by this particular chapter of Dylan lore, and he wrote about it recently on his Substack, Range and Basin. Last week, Jason stopped by the studio to talk more about why he finds this story so compelling.
As far as I can tell, you can't really source this story to anything else. It doesn't seem like it, maybe factually it happened. I don't want to accuse Clinton of completely making it up. He very well might have heard it, you know, from a secondhand source. Whether or not this sort of, let's say, extraordinary paranormal kind of thing happened, Bob Dylan does experience a dramatic conversion in 1978. He really does make a huge shift in his artistic presentation and songwriting.
What's compelling to you about that in terms of the lore of Dylan? Like, what do you like about the idea of Dylan in this moment having this supposed epiphany?
Dylan has always been a master craftsperson of persona. He's always been excellent at creating this air of a sort of aloof, unknowable figure. So I like the idea of a sort of weak and broken Bob Dylan.
It's humanizing.
Honestly. Well, it's humanizing, yeah. And it's deeply, we've all been there, you know,
sure,
on some level or another. So I like that about it. And it's satisfying in this way that that feels, I don't know, maybe a little deeper than just your average rock and roll urban legend.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I loved about the piece you wrote about this is you also you linked to this, I guess they're sort of in Bob Dylan mythology, they're referred to as sermons, these like long kind of rambling talks that he would give from the stage during this period. I mean, I guess he's always done that. But in this particular period, he was given to these meandering ruminations on the themes of the Bible.
Yeah.
I read the Bible a lot, you know, I mean, it just happens I do.
And yeah, one of the things I thought was really fascinating about it is there's one actually where he talks about being at performing at a college in Arizona.
We were playing in about 4 months ago someplace. It was at a college campus. I forget exactly where. It was Arizona, I think it was someplace. Is that where it was?
And what's fascinating to me about it is he's standing there and he's talking about, like, you know, on college campuses, they got these, they talk about ideas, you know, they got
yeah,
professors and stuff.
You know, it's like they have a higher learning people there. They teach them different, like, philosophies. And so people, they study all these different philosophies.
He's talking like somebody who's never been to a college campus or heard of a college class.
Right.
Which, like, is obviously not true. Like,
yeah,
this is somebody who makes, like, you know, references to philosophers in his lyrics. Like, he mm-hmm, obviously knows about these things. And yet, it's believable in that moment that he believes himself to be, have sort of a beginner's mind about these things in the midst of this religiosity that he was experiencing.
Yeah. Seeing him at the Willie Nelson's Outlaw Festival a couple weeks ago here, I don't think Dylan said, you know, a single word to the audience beyond, I think, introducing the band. It goes even further. He was, like, obscured by mm-hmm, a lamp on his piano. So you couldn't even really fully tell that Bob was up there, you know? So he's kind of this silent figure who's obscured and hidden. When you look at the Gospel trilogy, he's out in the open in a way that is very different than what we generally associate with Bob.
For all those who have eyes and all those who have ears, it is only he who can reduce me to tears.
I think about how humanizing it is and how when you're fresh with new convert energy, it's kind of totalizing. It's all you want to talk about. It's all you can focus on. And so, again, you see even the great master Bob Dylan himself, you know, just doing this all too human thing.
For me, there's a connection between that sense of authenticity and what was happening and this bigger idea that you're writing about in this piece that I really love, which you refer to as ecstatic truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a concept that I borrowed wholesale from the great Werner Herzog, who is a filmmaker and a writer. Ecstatic truth means that it feels true on some deep level that goes beyond our rationality.
Yeah, something about the idea that this would have happened to Bob Dylan in this hotel room makes this person, who obviously exists, but there are so many things about him that are hard to understand or make sense of, viewed through the lens of that incident, all of a sudden he comes into greater focus.
Yeah. What it's getting at, what it's pointing to, what it somehow illustrates, even in its potential falsity or whatever, is something that is real, does make sense. Art's where the ambiguities, it's where the facts don't, they're not the only thing that matter.
Totally. I mean, I'm also thinking in this moment, I hadn't thought about this until you just said that, about an explanation I often hear for why people love the Grateful Dead so much. And that explanation is that it's not about the fact that they always got to some apotheosis in their jams, because often they failed to get there.
Yeah.
But it was the persistent sense that they might, that there might be this moment of ecstasy that was going to be achieved not just by the musicians on the stage, but by them in communion with the 50,000 people in the middle of a field who had traveled from hundreds of miles to see them. The possibility of transcendent experience. There's an ecstatic truthiness to that.
I mean, it's true. The jams do sometimes meander and never get where they are, quote unquote, going, you know, or where you think that they should go.
Yeah. Sounds a lot like the lives we all live.
But it's like the lives we live. And it's like it's like when people say, you know, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. If the possibility of failure is in the room, that means that the possibility of something that's even beyond success, yes, is also in the room.
Well, and in your piece, I think you talk about the fact that Dylan has, in his live performances and on his records, almost never played any of his songs the same way twice.
And for a certain kind of listener, you're going to be frustrated when you go to see Dylan and you don't realize that he's playing It's All Over Now, Baby Blue until the second verse, you know,
right,
because he's doing it in such a sort of twisted and mangled version of it. And
there is
so,
no truth to
it's
what
not,
the song itself is.
The truth of the song is what's revealed each time you're playing that song. I think of Dylan's songs as a great repositories of incredible and profound truths. And you kind of have to be the one to excavate it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a truth that you and the artist are kind of finding together.
And I think maybe that's why this notion is fascinating to us. As the listener, you are not incidental to the brilliance. You actually are part of it. You have to be part of it in order for it to really, truly work. And so that notion that we create the truth together, I think that's real.
Well, I've been talking with Jason Woodbury, who wrote about Bob Dylan, his alleged moment of transcendence and enlightenment in a Tucson hotel room, and many other things on his Substack, Range and Basin. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always an awesome time hanging out and talking with you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Mark, do you know your astrological sign?
I do. I am an Aquarius.
Okay. Okay. I myself am a Taurus.
Okay.
I'm told that means I love food and comfortable chairs, which I have to say, tracks. Do you put much stock in being an Aquarius?
I can't say that I do, no.
Okay. Okay. Well, astrology has been on my mind lately, in part because of that conversation I had a moment ago with Jason about ecstatic truth and this idea of something feeling real, even if you can't prove it on a factual, rational basis, but also because of a study that our producer Amber told us about, which suggested that 27% of Americans believe in astrology, with even higher numbers amongst LGBTQ plus folks, where the figure is 43%. So in light of all that, I recently spoke with an astrologer named Dion Brown. Brown is not technically a trained astrologer, but he's the editor of Ion Arizona, a local queer culture magazine, and he writes the magazine's astrology section, which he calls Homoscopes.
It is probably one of the most read parts of the magazine, actually, and I've been doing them for 10 years anyways.
Oh, wow. Okay. And how do you know that they are as popular as they are? Do you hear from readers about them?
Yes. They've said, you know, whoever your astrologer is spot on. That is absolutely me. People frequently comment on it. We have done informal polls with our readers before about what they like best about the magazine, what they don't care as much about the magazine. And a lot of the readers will comment, Homoscopes are their favorite.
Okay. So as the astrologer in question who is being praised in these conversations, how do you go about writing the homoscopes?
I'm not standing out in the yard gazing up at the stars and the universe and, you know, asking for help from the infinite. Mm-hmm. But I do consult a variety of reliable sources on the web, and I cherry pick. Sometimes I look at actual astronomy to see what is happening. And if they say that there's a conjunction of five planets, I will look up and see what does the conjunction of these five planets mean astrologically.
Mm-hmm.
And I put that together into, you know, a few sentences for each star sign.
Yeah. And am I right that, I mean, the nature of a lot of the homoscopes currently is you'll say things like expect a surprise this month or expect some resolution on a family issue or you might get a visit from a stranger, that kind of thing, right?
Yes, there's always, you know, Sam, whether it's a fortune cookie or tea leaves or palm reading, there's always that little X factor that it's like, oh, a stranger.
Right.
Oh, my gosh, I've been having trouble with my aunt. What's going to happen? I think people like to do a little bit of the detective work
right
on their own to try to puzzle out, is this all accurate? I try to give it a queer spin. Maybe I'll try to relate it to something locally that's happening within the LGBTQ community. You know, it's a good time to go to the Charlie's Chili Cook-Off.
So when you're writing these, is it a tongue-in-cheek thing, or are you sort of earnestly trying to offer folks some advice without, you know, actually knowing who they are?
It's a little bit of both. I try to make it kind of cheeky. The homoscopes are not going to change in two sentences. You're not going to change anybody's life.
Well,
and
maybe not. You never know.
maybe not. But, you know, I have read some horoscopes that will be like, this month, you know, Jupiter is clashing with Saturn and financial disaster awaits, and a business venture goes south. And I discovered that people like hope. You have to give people hope. And so I try to, even in those two sentences, I try to let people know, expect bottomless mimosas at brunch. That's a pretty queer spin, I would say. You know, I mean, I know straight people go to brunch too.
True, but you know,
people don't want to be scared. Yeah. There's enough scary things in real life. Mm-hmm. Astrology is not about disparaging your life. I think that's why a lot of queer people do like astrology, is nobody's been kicked out of the universe for being gay.
Right. Well, so let me ask you a little bit more about this, because one of the reasons we got interested in talking to you is because our producer Amber noticed this really amazing survey that came out recently. This was a survey of more than 9,500 adults last fall. And it said that 27% of the respondents, quote, believe in astrology, which is already a pretty significant number. But the numbers were really high amongst LGBTQ folks. What do you make of those numbers?
I think it's about self-discovery. Like, people will say, when did you come out? It's like, well, I think that coming out is always kind of a lifelong process in many ways.
Right.
You know, with everyone you meet. It's also, I think astrology is non-binary. Venus was always a woman and Mars was always a man. A lot of that is being erased by astrologists.
Interesting. So, I mean, broadly speaking, from what you're saying, there is just less a sense of strictures, boundaries.
Exactly. There's no damnation.
Right. Yeah. Well, and
you know, it's
in the spirit of self-discovery, I'm really struck by, to go back to, you know, the examples of some of the homoscopes we were talking about before, you know, if it's something like expect a surprise this month or the resolution of a family issue, it's left to the reader to discover within themselves what they might want to attach that prediction to. It's not as though you're giving them a prescription about, you know, keep an eye on your aunt whoever. It's more that you're kind of prompting this look inward, where there might be something unresolved that a homoscope could just gently prompt you to think about a resolution for.
That's it perfectly. I think people are always looking for something optimistic. We all have a place among the stars and the planets from the moment of our birth. I think that that's another thing that people like about astrology.
Yeah.
Is that we are assigned from the moment we're born. You know, if you were born on April Fool's Day, there's a spot for you.
Right. And to the point that you were making earlier, if you are a queer person, there are some organizations, whether they're religious organizations or other parts of life, where you're explicitly told there is no spot for you here. You're not welcome here. But astrology kind of implicitly says, yes, you are part of this. You are included.
You know, when you look at these pictures of the universe and the Hubble telescope and all that, and you see this vast field of stars and planets and galaxies, it's like, do I fit in? And I think that this is a small way of anybody, not just queer people, but feeling, you know what, I am one of those little stars.
Yeah. Well, Dion Brown is the editor of Ion Arizona and the astrologer for the monthly homoscopes section. Dion, thank you so much.
Sam, thank you. This is a real pleasure and a real thrill.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. In an effort to meet someone special, some people go to the bars while others prefer organized events like a speed dating kind of evening. Online dating platforms have also become popular in recent years. And then there's matchmakers. Aliza Ben-Shalom is a matchmaker, dating coach, and host of the show Jewish Matchmaking on Netflix, which followed Jewish singles in the U.S. and Israel. The show's future is uncertain, but Ben-Shalom has written a book on the topic of matchmaking, appropriately called Matchmaker, Matchmaker, released earlier this year. Let's revisit my 2023 conversation with Aliza Ben-Shalom.
I started when I was younger. I grew up not religious, and I had friends, and people started dating, and I just started to see people. They didn't know they were interested in each other, but I knew. And I just started to notice that. And then in college, I started to set my friends up very casually. And I obviously, nobody really thinks of it as like a job or a profession. It's not what you'd go to university for, that's for sure. And it wasn't until in my mid-20s, after I got married, actually late 20s, I had a couple kids, and I started working online as a professional matchmaker, that it started to become a hobby slash strong interest and curiosity, like, ooh, what could I do with this?
Mm. May I ask how you met your husband, given what you do for a living now?
Yes, we were at a retreat in Orlando. It was a Jewish singles retreat. After the retreat, we left dating other people, but we were from the same community in Philadelphia. And a couple months later, we started dating, and we had met at a Shabbat table, a Friday night dinner, but because we didn't have an official matchmaker, we brought one in, and it was the rabbi that he was closest to.
So I'm curious why you think it is that matchmaking seems to be sort of having a moment now. Obviously, you know, there are a lot of shows on TV, yours included, dealing with matchmaking, but it seems to sort of be going beyond just in the popular culture. Like, it seems like more and more people are turning to matchmaking to try to find a mate.
I think people are more excited about love these days, and I think people are really busy, to be quite honest. And in general, when we get busy, we kind of farm things out to other people. So we get the support of professionals to help us, and I think that people are turning to matchmakers in the modern day because there's a lot going on. And hey, if you can take care of my dating life, I can go do something else. I can work. I can work out. I can hang out with my friends, and somebody else will set me up. It's fine. Don't worry. She'll call me in a couple of days. She'll have a date.
Well, it's interesting because I think, you know, maybe in decades past, not too many decades, but one or two, for example, a lot of people saw online dating as kind of that kind of thing, right? Like, instead of having to go to a bar or try to meet somebody at the grocery store or, you know, something like that, you go online. It was sort of a more efficient way to do things. But matchmaking is kind of, it's almost like a new old school version of doing that.
Yes, absolutely. And online is still popular.
What would you say is the hardest part of doing your job?
Oh, the hardest part is really the patience for the person, the person that we're trying to find. Working with the person, no problem. Getting through the process, no problem. Whether it's coaching or setting them up, but it's not just setting them up, because I don't like to just set people up with somebody. I'm not looking to keep people busy. I really want to set them up with their person. And so finding somebody that's good or good enough or close, it like doesn't hit the spot for me. It's really, I don't have that. I'm like, oh, but I do always have to remember that. Listen, I have my preferences for what I think is going to work best, but I have had matches surprise me, and I have had people choose partners where I went, oh, I didn't think you were going to go for that one. Oh, I'm so happy. I'm so glad it worked out. But I didn't know if they could stretch, and people sometimes surprise me. So I think patience in the process is really the hardest thing.
Have you had it sort of go the other way, where you were pretty certain that two people would really click and they ended up not?
Yes. And it is heartbreaking for me.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we have to not get too invested. I had a couple once, and I had them come over for the weekend, and I wanted them to get to know each other, spend time, and I was going to be there to help facilitate. And it was what I would call DOA, dead on arrival. Mm. They met, and I don't know what happened. He lost his personality. He stopped talking. I've never actually seen anything like that since then.
Wow.
He could, and they had actually met on like the phone, they were talking, they were schmoozing beforehand, and they clicked. It was like they were practically ready to get engaged from a week of conversations. And in person, it was DOA. And I'm going, oh my gosh. And she was devastated because there was a connection before they walked into the same room, and they walked into the same room and the energy just left. I just never saw anything like that.
Do you find that people tend to be pretty honest with you when they're talking about what they're looking for? Or do they really have a good sense of what it is that they're looking for when they're talking with you?
I think that people try to be honest, but at the same time, not appear too picky. So they're not, they dance around the subject sometimes. They don't say things straightforward. I mean, direct people, they'll tell you exactly what they want. But other people, they're a little bit more playful with you. And I sometimes have to pull things out of people. And I think sometimes people are talking it out and clarifying as they go. Mm. And they don't exactly, they know what they don't want, but they don't always know what they do want. And when they know what they do want, they don't always know if what they want will actually be good for them long term.
Well, I would assume that is something you consider part of your job, right? Sort of talking through this with your client to make sure that everybody's on the same page and maybe help them figure out what it is they're actually looking for.
Absolutely. And figuring that out to me is extremely important. There's no sense in really even setting anybody up unless we know what they want and what they're looking for. What they get, I don't know if it's going to be the same thing, but at least knowing what they want and making peace with it. If they don't get what they want, we're at least clear. You have to be open yet not. I don't want to say it any other way, right? We're open and at the same time, no, I know who I am. I know what I want. So there's a fine line there. But yeah, it's coaching, mentoring. It's definitely the heart of what matchmaking is to me.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you grew up in a not super religious family. You have become more religious since getting married. I'm wondering how that's affected your matchmaking, especially because you've been doing it for quite a while now.
Right. So I started in 2007 and I came from a secular world. I was Jewish. I loved my Judaism, but I wasn't practicing anything. And then I became observant. So I knew the secular world. I know the religious world. And for me, it's really helped me to help anybody who's looking for love in the Jewish world.
So I've got to ask, based on what you do and the people with whom you work, how often does somebody sort of walk by you and hum a particular song from a particular musical to you?
Matchmaker, matchmaker.
You probably know all the words, right?
I know the whole chorus. They sing. My husband is probably the one that hums that the most, actually. He's got a great voice. Spectacular.
Well, I guess that's good if he's going to be the one singing it the most.
Yes.
All right. Aliza, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was matchmaker Aliza Ben Shalom speaking with me in 2023. Well, whether you put your trust in Bob Dylan, whether you put your trust in the stars or a matchmaker, we thank you for putting your trust in us here at the show every weekday morning. And we hope you'll do it again tomorrow morning at 9. We'll have our weekly news cap and so much more coming your way. For Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you then.